Daily blogs attract lots of comments from the general public. They're usually anonymous and often inane. But Bradley Campbell from Rhode Island Public Radio reports on one masked writer whose comments earned him a job at one of the country's top publications.
Years ago, a writer was clicking through various blogs online. The writer stumbled his way to the Atlantic website, and on their webpage, he saw the blog of a senior editor whose name the writer couldn't pronounce. That editor was Ta-Nehisi Coates, and his blog at the Atlantic impressed the writer. It chose topics off the beaten path, examining everything from Alexis de Tocqueville to Iron Man 2. And the writer says something else about Coates' blog was surprising.
His comment sections were actually worth reading. Comment sections are the cesspools of the internet. They're the fetid sinks into which we throw the things that we'd rather not acknowledge we produce.
But this comment section expanded upon ideas rather than going tit for tat. The writer couldn't resist. He posted a comment, but he was careful not to reveal his true name. He thought it could pose problems, so he chose a clever pseudonym, Cynic. At the time, he had no idea this would change his professional life forever. He just liked it.
Commenting can be cathartic, particularly if you enter into it without the expectation that anyone will ever read or respond to it.
But plenty of people did respond to Cynic.
And I went on commenting, because when I posted a comment, people seemed interested.
Cynic wasn't original. His comments provided historical context to each blog post. His tone was civil, especially when he talked about Ulysses S. Grant. And down in New York City, the Atlantic's Ta-Nehisi Coates took notice of his words.
You know, any sort of debate that we were ever in, he was just great at making it bigger. You know what I mean? And making it, you know, fuller and having some, you know, sort of meat to it. He was just like the master mold for what I would have wanted a commenter to be.
Coates knew he had a talented writer on his hands, so he began talking to the editorial director of The Atlantic, Bob Cohn. They discussed ways to bring Cynic out of the shadows.
We just began talking. As I say, I was so eager to find ways to pluck out the great commenters from Ta-Nehisi's blog and bring them forward and present them to Atlantic readers.
Coates reached out to Cynic, and with Cohn's blessing, Cynic soon appeared as a guest writer on the blog. It's a select honor that's been bestowed to other, more notable writers, like Pulitzer Prize-winning author Michael Chabon. But readers still didn't know the true identity of Cynic, so the guessing games began. Readers thought he was everyone from President Obama to actor George Wendt.
There was a guy who still posts on the site, and every time a Cynic would post, he would post in all caps under him, "Who are you?"
After about 3 years since Cynic's first comment, Cohn offered him the gig as an Atlantic correspondent. But it came with a catch. Cynic had to disclose his true identity. That made Cynic leery. He wasn't Superman or even the escapist, just a graduate student in history at Brandeis University. Cynic was nervous about how his prolific commenting would play with serious academics. He was in the thick of completing his dissertation. But in the end, Cynic agreed. And to his relief,
overwhelmingly, the reaction I got from my fellow academics was encouragement.
His demasking and official entry came with more celebration on the blog. As Coates put it, sometimes among the chorus, a singular voice rises above. Cynic has been writing at The Atlantic for about a year now as a correspondent, in addition to his studies. You can find him under his byline, Yoni Applebaum. For NPR News, I'm Bradley Campbell in Providence.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green. Our series, Family Matters, is following the lives of three families facing a reality that is growing more common in the United States. Multiple generations living under the same roof, caring for one another. Today, we're going to meet the Martin Hawkins family from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and they define what we mean when we say sandwich generation. As you'll hear, two women are juggling their own jobs, finding time for their kids, and also caring for the woman at the center of our story, the matriarch of the family, an 87-year-old woman who likes to sing.
When all the lights are low, may not be new, but I like it. How about you?
We met Snootsy, that's what her family calls her, one morning outside the home of LaDonna Martin, who's one of her caregivers. Her real name is Annabelle Bowers, and she was singing along to an iPod, still smiling from the evening she and LaDonna shared the night before.
Oh, we had a good time last night.
We almost went for drinks. How about it?
Yeah, we needed our margarita.
We don't always tell everyone. I said, we don't always tell everyone. That's our little secret.
That's our secret.
One secret? Snootsy was a bartender for years, and she still brags about how nobody had the guts to mess with her. She lost her husband years ago, and then in 2009, she became frail enough that her family knew it was time to take her in. Two members of the family took that on. LaDonna, who's married to Snootsy's grandson, and also Kelly Martin, Snootsy's granddaughter.
It was funny. I said to my other granddaughter, I said, Kelly, when you and LaDonna decided to take me into your homes, you didn't think I'd live so long. And she says, no, I didn't, Grandma.
And she'll say all the time, I just feel so bad. You guys are, you know, doing all this. And we're like, we wanted, we chose to do this.
And it's clear it was not an easy choice. That was Kelly speaking right there. She and LaDonna are in their 40s, both nurses, both moms. LaDonna has a son and daughter still at home. Kelly has a daughter in college and another daughter getting ready for college next fall. To make everything work, to do all the juggling, the two women hatched a plan. Snootsy spends 2 weeks with Kelly's family, and then she switches houses and spends the next 2 weeks with LaDonna.
And so how daunting was that decision when you two decided, you know, we're just going to take this on?
Honestly, at first we were like, well, we have to take her in. What else are we going to do? And it was like, but then as time has gone, you know, the stress of it is just weighing. We would keep her and we'll keep her till, you know, we can't. But it becomes a stressor. You just kind of never feel like you can kind of do what you want and come and go. Like, I can't just, if my kid said, Mom, come pick me up, you know, let's run to the mall or run to this sport. Well, I have to make sure someone's going to be here with her.
It's like having another, like, toddler or something. Like, you can't just pick up and go. It's, you have to think everything, plan everything ahead. Because lots of times where we're going, you know, we can't take her. We do have a wheelchair and certain different games and stuff. We will just put her in the wheelchair and take her with us. But a lot of times that's not, you know, doable.
And I can, when she was talking about how much she sees the two of you do for her, I mean, she clearly sees how much you do. Is, what is, if you look back over the last 2 years, the toughest moment?
One thing when you do have like your moments, like LaDonna knows exactly what I'm going through, and we're kind of, I can be her sounding board and she's mine because we're living it.
You can hear the stress in those voices, but there are also so many moments of joy.
Hi, Snoots.
Hi, honey.
This is the sound of LaDonna's two kids coming home from school. They're greeted by Snootsy, who's smiling on the recliner in the living room.
How are you?
Good.
How was school?
Pretty good. I did lots of tests today.
Did you?
And Steve, getting to see your great-grandma every day when you come home from school, I mean, the kids told me that it's something they really cherish.
I'm glad you brought up that part, David, because as we've mentioned from the beginning, this can be painful, it can be expensive. We heard it compared to caring for another toddler. But this is also something, living together, different generations in the same household, something that families choose to do and that they find rewarding in many cases.
And you could feel from this family and from the others we're following, too, that as hard as it gets, I mean, they grow closer together through this whole process.
And although we've talked about the financial difficulties that can be involved here, if you have to quit a job, for example, to take care of an elderly parent or grandparent, there can be financial benefits to this as well, can there not?
Yeah, and that financial benefit, Steve, is something that I've spoken to this family a lot about as well.
So it can be a double-edged situation. And in this situation, the Martin Hawkins family has gone to an expert, in effect, for advice, a lawyer, someone who specializes in what is called elder law. Her name is Marielle Hazen, and she gave us some insight into the family situation. When somebody comes to you, the way that the Martins and the Hawkins came to you, what do you do as an elder care lawyer?
Well, as an elder care lawyer, I do a broad range of things, and elder law is really a specialty in understanding the public benefits for individuals. It also deals with establishing decision makers for individuals. It deals with Medicare, so when those both public benefits issues, Medicare and Medicaid benefits, and also veterans benefits. a lot of estate planning, a lot of tax work. So elder law is really a broad umbrella of a lot of different areas that impact not just the elderly, but people of any age who may have disability issues, incapacity issues.
Now, the Hawkins and the Martin families, who we've been following, when they came to you, what did they need help with the most?
Well, there are a lot of different issues going on there, and really would just say that you know, obviously there are two. There's a granddaughter and a granddaughter-in-law providing care, you know, doing so at sacrifice to their families, but they don't view it as a sacrifice. But there is a monetary sacrifice that happens, and so dealing with that and making it a workable situation in a way that, you know, everyone is going to be protected and needs are going to be met is, you know, one of the aspects of any family caregiving situation.
So is the next question then whether, if you're taking care of Grandma, if you're taking care of Snootsy in this case, the question is it fair to ask some compensation from her, and how do you arrange that?
In that situation, Grandma's not actually paying for caregiving services. She had a son who had passed away and had left resources to be used for her benefit. But in most circumstances, people don't have that extra set of funding. And so it could be mom or dad or grandma or grandpa who is paying directly for the caregiver services.
I understand you helped these two families, the Martins and the Hawkinses, drop a legal agreement. What did you do?
Well, again, talking generally about these kinds of circumstances, people, I see attorneys call them different things, either a family caregiver agreement or a personal care agreement, where there's an arrangement for the caregiver to be compensated for services that are being provided.
This has got to be an extraordinarily complex thing to wade into because we're dealing with this clash of emotion and practicality. You want to take care of your mom. You want to take care of your grandma, your grandpa. You don't want to charge for that. They never charged you. But at the same time, there are practical considerations, and the money needs to come from somewhere.
That's right. There are practical considerations, and I see a lot of family members making a lot of sacrifice, leaving the workforce, losing their retirement benefits, losing health care benefits in order to make sure their parents are provided the best care.
Marielle Hazen is an elder law attorney in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Her clients include the Martin and Hawkins families, who are among the families we're following for our series, Family Matters. Thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
And you can see images of Snootsy's family and read about an insurance policy that many people are taking out to fund their later years, all part of David's series, Family Matters. It's at NPR.org.
As Eleanor Beardsley just mentioned in her report, all eyes will be on how France's new president gets along with Germany. And let's get the view from Germany now from NPR's Eric Westerveld, who's in Berlin. Eric, good morning.
Good morning, David.
And, you know, German Chancellor Angela Merkel has been committed to this policy of pressing debt-troubled countries to cut deficits, trim spending. I mean, we've read those headlines for some time now. But we hear one analyst in Eleanor's report there saying that Berlin might have to compromise on these austerity measures. Is there any sign of that yet?
Well, David, I'm not seeing many signs of compromise here so far. I mean, the chancellor yesterday and senior officials in her party are making it pretty clear that the emphasis is going to remain on maintaining, you know, strict budget-cutting targets and structural reforms, you know, such as opening up restrictive labor markets and tax reforms, but not on any substantial new plans for increased spending or stimulus, which Germany really still strongly opposes. Yesterday at a press meeting, Merkel once again ruled out any debt-financed growth programs. She pledged to work with the new French president and welcome him to Berlin with open arms, as she put it, very soon. But, you know, as Eleanor pointed out, she also made clear, David, she's not interested in any reworking of this European fiscal pact, you know, a pact that's all about belt tightening. She said yesterday that pact is not negotiable.
Well, what does history say? Can a new French leader have some leverage and be able to force a German leader to make some changes?
Well, we'll see. Obviously, the French-German alliance is important, and Merkel made clear yesterday she's willing to work closely with the new president. But I think time will tell. The ground may shift a little. There's a growing sense here in Germany that austerity alone is not working, and that in some cases it has made things worse, that it's been too rigid and implemented too fast. And, you know, the opposition Social Democrats here have praised Hollande's victory and said it signals a new direction for all of Europe. So there is some pressure there. And Merkel's under some pressure at home as well, because her CDU party suffered, you know, a setback in local elections over the weekend, which adds new pressures. There are some winds blowing for some kind of potential change. But I have to stress that really the deep commitment across party lines is still to cost cutting and not, you know, new spending plans.
You know, Eric, as we look forward, if there are doubts growing about, you know, the austerity measures that have been in place, are there alternatives out there?
Well, President-elect Hollande has talked about, you know, new stimulus plans and a growth pact, but that's really not in the cards for Germany right now. I mean, there's talk of using unspent EU structural funds for stimulus, David, but that's pretty low-hanging fruit. It's really not that much money. It's unlikely to have a big impact, and it could be politically popular, but it's really not going to be a game changer on the ground here.
What about other countries around the EU, these other austerity-supporting leaders? I mean, are they still firmly behind Merkel, or is there some weakening there?
Well, I think she's pretty isolated right now in Europe, David. I mean, Sarkozy's on the way out. He was a key ally, despite a rocky relationship at times. The Netherlands, another key ally, has been thrown into political turmoil after the coalition government there recently collapsed, largely over, you know, a right-wing party's opposition to austerity measures. So she's sticking to her guns, but she is increasingly, I think, isolated on the continent.
You know, Greece is facing a lot of new pressure today as well. The dominant political parties there that supported the EU bailouts were defeated in favor of far-right and far-left parties in parliament. And, you know, we're talking about France, but the true German nightmare might end up being Greece yet again, you know, falling into political and economic crisis.
Absolutely, David. I mean, Merkel yesterday, you know, had a strong warning for Greece, saying, you know, you need to stick to your cost-cutting goals and structural reform plans. But there's a big fear in Berlin that the door will now be opened in Greece to try to renegotiate the terms of these two bailouts. You know, there are some commentators in the papers this morning saying, you know, here we go again with Greece. So while all eyes are on France, really the fear is about Greece backsliding and backtracking. And there's a kind of donor fatigue among German voters, especially after these two bailouts of Greece, also bailouts of Ireland and Portugal. They feel like they've done their share to support, you know, their struggling neighbors in the Eurozone currency. And they really want the emphasis to remain on deficit cutting.
Eric, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
It's NPR's Eric Westerveld speaking to us from Berlin about the new political reality unfolding in Europe.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Now we hear from a woman whose story is her own, and yet is the story of many young people of the post-colonial world. She grew up in Kenya with a large and sprawling extended family, went to Europe to further her education, and as a young adult developed a friendly but distant relationship with her younger brother, who was a son of the American diaspora. But then that distant brother became the most powerful man in the world. In a new book, And Then Life Happens, Auma Obama sheds light on her relationship with her brother, President Barack Obama, and on the sometimes heartbreaking story of the Obama family in Kenya. Auma Obama now lives in Kenya, where she has set up her own foundation called Sauti Kuu, or Powerful Voices, which seeks to help young people become more economically empowered. And she joins us now from New York. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
I read a quote in an old article in the New York Times that said, quote, piecing together Barack Obama's family is like piecing together the world. It's a rich experience, but not easy, unquote. But I think your book goes a long way toward doing that. So could you just briefly explain how you and the president are related, or where you are together on the family tree? How about that?
Well, it's on the level of my father, because we share a father, although his mother was American, and my mother was Kenyan, hence the same surname.
And you are just a year apart.
Yes, we are.
Well, you know, the way you describe, I think, your father is very moving, but it also conveys, I think, very candidly how difficult a figure he was for you at times to get your arms around. And I think the way you describe him is kind of caught between two worlds. Could you just describe that a little bit for us?
Yes, and actually that's part of the motivation around the book, because even as a child I could see that my father was caught between two worlds, and that's the African, more traditional world, and the Western, in this case, more American world that he had gotten to know when he studied. And the thing was that with our patriarchal family structures, where the man is, you know, got to be a certain type of man, he's got to behave a certain way. And then there was the intellectual side of him that was influenced by the Western world, where he really, you know, wanted to be in dialogue with people, whether they're women or men, and not necessarily have to bring out his masculinity more than anything else. He had to struggle with being between the two worlds. And he actually loved our culture in many ways because he was very, obviously he was very comfortable in it because that's how he grew up. But at the same time, he had adjusted and adapted to the Western culture. But maybe he wasn't necessarily that comfortable. But because that was what one did, he did it. And I watched many occasions and many examples where he was just torn and sometimes just didn't know how to behave because he was trying to please almost like two masters. And he wasn't very good at juggling, which through the book, I try to understand him. And more the reason why I'm able to understand him is because I go through the same experience. I've kind of learned to juggle through the cultures and the different races, the different languages. And he had that experience as an adult. So he was too much of the one and very well embedded in the other. And that was quite a conflict for him. And I watched that as I was growing up.
I wanted to talk a little bit both about your struggle and his, if you don't mind, because his struggle caused no small amount of pain, particularly for the women in his life. You are the daughter of his first wife.
Yes.
Yes. And then when he went to the U.S. to study, he married President Obama's mother. And he actually wrote, he actually wrote to his father, yes, asking permission, which was granted. But then when he moved back to Kenya without President Obama's mother, he then married a third woman who would not accept a plural marriage.
Yes.
You never really got a chance to talk to him about it. So how did you piece together his struggle?
Well, it's not so much about being able to talk to him about it. It's seeing what happened. But one thing I have to correct is very often the impression that is given is that we were a polygamous family and that the different wives were wives that were running in parallel. Actually, I very often joke about it and say that my father was very Western because, you know, in the Western world, you have people getting married, separating, divorcing, and marrying again. You know, many people are not into their second or third marriage. And he, similarly, when he and my mom separated, because the Luo tradition doesn't really have divorce, and I write about it in my book, so they separated. They were no longer together. So really, he was just a man of the times in terms of the Western world because he was in relationships that didn't work, which for me is not extraordinary. And that's something that I find is sometimes a challenge to relay because we're in the public eye, because people expect something extraordinary of us, the mm-hmm. relatives of my brother, who are just basically very ordinary people with very ordinary, you know, mundane situations and coping mechanisms and experiences. And my father was no exception. You know, the thing that was brilliant about him was his brain. You know, he was a brilliant scholar, but in reality, he was just, you know, just another guy, a regular guy.
Well, you know, I think that's one of the things that's kind of charming about your book is that you're very humble about all of that. You also talk about your own kind of personal struggles and figuring out where to fit in and how to fit in. But one thing that is in your book matches up with those who have read President Obama's memoir is that the two of you, even though you were not raised together, you kind of fell in love immediately, you know, as brother and sister.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, why is that? You both describe it, the meeting in a similar fashion in which that you kind of met each other and it was instant sibling love. And I wonder what is it that binds the two of you?
I don't know, you know, and I'm just grateful for it. It just happened that way. And maybe we are very similar in certain ways that we gravitated towards each other because, you know, we spent a lot of time talking together. You know, he listened a lot to what I had to say. And it was just such a bonus to know that he's my brother and he's part of my family. And he was very familiar in many ways, partly because my father had always talked about him. He was very proud of him, but also because there were just things about him that I could relate very well to. And, you know, I can't explain it beyond that. You know, I'm just lucky. I was lucky.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with Auma Obama. And as you might have guessed from her name, she is the sister of President Barack Obama. We're talking about her new memoir, And Then Life Happens. You mentioned in the book, which I thought was also funny, is how when he first was elected to the United States Senate, you really didn't understand what all the fuss was.
Yeah, I didn't. Not at all.
When did you figure it out?
I think it was when I came to the inauguration because of the historic significance. You know, the fact that there were very few black men who had made it to that position. So that was very significant. And I was really, really proud of him. And, you know, I left it at that. That's what he wanted to do. He'd achieved it. He was going to obviously do it well. And that was it, I thought. And then life happened.
Yeah, I was going to mention that. I was going to ask about that. You wrote of that time when he was first elected to the Senate, "I was astounded at the effect he had on others." Could you describe that a little bit about what you saw?
Yes, that was amazing because I get along with my brother. I think he's a great guy. We have a lot of fun. You know, I that energy around him, I enjoy that a lot. But I enjoyed it on a personal, individual level. And when he became senator, he spoke at an event, and the people were just, you know, seemed to be mesmerized by what he had to say. And that experience of somebody being able to move people so powerfully and really have them believe in that person as somebody who can really make a difference in their lives, you know, I saw it at a level that I'd never seen before. And for me, it was a little bit of a surprise because at the end of the day, he's just my brother. So it was like, okay. Maybe he's a bit more than just my brother, you know?
Yes. But by the time he ran for the presidency, you were clued in by then that this was huge. This was a big deal.
When he ran initially?
For president, yeah.
You just realize it as it goes along. And I think maybe that's a good thing. Because with no expectation, no idea of what was coming, it's like a child who gets an injection for the first time. You know, you don't know it's going to hurt until you've had it and it's over. You know, so, and I don't want to say that in a negative way, as if it's, you know, it was a negative experience. It wasn't at all. It was a very new experience with no idea. We were just participating in something that was happening, and we were part of it. And it kind of caught us a lot by surprise, but you just work through it. The experience was really something very, very powerful. And I write about it in the book, how powerful it was, you know.
You mentioned in the book how you wanted to be accessible to the American media as a way to explain a bit of your family background, and also because you didn't want them to bother your, you know, elderly relatives, too. Mm-hmm. You know, and you paint, I think, a very moving but also complicated picture of the Kenyan side of the Obama family. I just wondered if you've been worried at all about being misinterpreted, or has that happened? I mean, I'm noting, for example, that there's a conservative writer who has taken pains to explain the president's political philosophy by saying that his father was an anti-colonialist, and so therefore this is kind of his worldview, even though, as you, of course, note, and as I would think most people know, they spent very little time together. Does that worry you at all?
You know, the book does more than talk just about my brother and my father. It really is a book about my journey. And part of my journey is the experience of diversity, different cultures, being with different types of people, just being able to accommodate and be able to adjust and integrate into situations that are very, very different. And every single family has such diversity in the family. And I think if people read my book, they will recognize, because they're just human stories. And the trouble with many of the books that feel so pressed to explain the Obama family, very often the work is work that is, you know, people are quoting what they're kind of like almost things that they've heard, or they feel this necessity to present us as being something extraordinary or something that has to be different now because we have this really extraordinary person who's made it to such great heights. And what my book is really just trying to say is that, no, we're really very ordinary people, and that's not going to change.
Well, before we let you go, I do want to mention that you feel a sense of mission, in part, which you talk about in the book. I wanted to ask about that. The book concludes with the lines, "I am aware that as an Obama, I now have a real chance to make a difference. For me, a door has opened, and I too want to open doors for others." Tell us a little bit more about how you are doing this in your own work.
Well, what has happened is that I worked for almost 5 years with CARE USA. And after that time, I've now actually just started to work with my own foundation, which I founded a while back, but couldn't really commit that much too. And the young people we work with are underprivileged young people from the urban slums or the poor rural areas. And many of these young people don't believe they exist because they live in such circumstances where they're not considered important. They don't even have an identity. They don't believe in self. And how can you achieve anything if you don't believe in yourself? And a lot of the work we do, and we do use a lot of sports to help young people get some self-esteem, like themselves, and get confident so that they can actually make decisions around what happens in their lives and make a difference to their lives and hence make a difference to their communities. And that's kind of like the way I feel that I can open doors and make opportunities available. And I'm lucky that with that name, which I really do appreciate, and I know that, you know, I have to honor it in that way, it gives me the possibility to do that. I have a platform.
Auma Obama's memoir, And Then Life Happens, is now available in English, previously published in German, and she was kind enough to join us from our studios in New York City. Auma Obama, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Now it's time to open up the pages of the Washington Post magazine. That's something we do just about every week for interesting stories about the way we live now. And over the weekend, many fans flocked to the theaters to see the comic book classic turned movie, The Avengers. The film brought in more than $200 million in its opening weekend. That's a record for any movie's first 3 days.
Dr. Banner, your work is unparalleled, and I'm a huge fan of the way you lose control and turn into an enormous green rage monster.
Thanks.
So don't be shocked when your friends and neighbors start showing up places dressed like characters from the movie, because Iron Man, Captain America, the Hulk, and Thor have actually been taking over trade show conventions like Comic-Con and PAX East for years. Our next guest recently attended one such convention on a much smaller scale. Mysticon takes place every February in Virginia and features activities for gamers, Trekkies, horror fans, and all such folk. Here to tell us more about his experience at Mysticon is writer George Gonzalez. His story, Lost in Space, was featured in this week's Washington Post magazine. Welcome. Thanks for joining us. And I see you're dressed kind of in disguise as like a regular guy. So thanks for that.
These are my day-to-day clothes.
These are your day-to-day clothes.
Yeah.
Well, so first of all, who are these people that you call LARPers and Schlarpers?
This was something that I found out about when I went down to the convention at Mysticon. And a LARP is a live-action role player, and it's someone who creates their own character and acts out that character's ideas or thoughts with other LARPers. And Schlarpers are superhero live-action role players who are the same thing but with a superhero edge.
A Schlarper was recently in the news in this area because he dressed as Batman, and he was, of course, stopped in traffic because apparently he was trying to stop crime or something. And then there was another example where somebody else there were a couple of people who've kind of run afoul of law enforcement because they actually were attempting to stop crime or, you know, and act out their role fully. Most of the people that you met at the convention, they don't do that, right? Or they limit their role play to conventions like this.
I believe so, yes.
That's a good diplomatic answer. Well, what attracts people to this?
I think it's an opportunity to just unleash your imagination. When people go to these conventions, they really can do whatever they want, you know, within means. But they're really there to interact with other people, other enthusiasts who are really into the same ideas that most other people aren't even aware of.
How do people get started on this? I mean, you noted yourself that you're a gamer. So you're kind of interested in where gaming fits into this, and gamers are part of this community. But the people you met who really, you know, immersed in it, particularly the role players, how did they get started?
They usually said that they got involved because someone else told them about it. And they said, I was talking to this one guy who said, hey, you know, when I was in high school, there were these kind of weird people who introduced me to this new concept of playing games. And it's real social. It's an opportunity to interact with people and talk and do whatever you want.
Was it mainly male or female, or was it pretty mixed?
It seemed pretty mixed. I expected more of a male dominance, but there were a good number of women there as well.
You know, is this really any different in a way from kind of Renaissance, you know, weekends? I mean, there's a huge in this area also like a Renaissance festival where people kind of dress up in medieval garb and do medieval things. Is this along the same lines?
I think it's the same thing, yeah, except it has more of a sci-fi bent to it.
Sci-fi bent to it. Now, you actually, in your story, you're not really being mean, but it sounds a little mean.
Oh,
but you
okay.
Talk about a hierarchy of uncoolness
Oh, yes.
And how the people who attend these conventions are often considered, you know, geeks and nerds.
Sure.
But you and you say that with love because you consider yourself kind of part of the uncoolness. But in the hierarchy of uncoolness, where did you determine these folks were?
Well, I self-identify as a nerd. I kind of have the classic look of a nerd where I have glasses, I have poor posture. When I was in high school, I had acne. When I was in high school, I was in the marching band. Those people are easy to pick out in a crowd. You can see them and be like, yeah, that guy's a nerd. That guy's a dork. But the same hierarchy exists for people who are into science fiction and horror stuff and fantasy stuff. And generally, you have people who play video games. And they're generally accepted because you have everyone knows who gamers are. Like, they're playing it on their iPhones or on their iPads, or they're on their computers, and they spend a lot of time with it.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with writer George Gonzalez. His story about the Mysticon science fiction and fantasy convention was featured in this week's Washington Post magazine. You know, one of the things that was fascinating to me about this is that I think that many people think of people who are very involved in gaming or in fantasy play as being antisocial, that they're engaged in it because they don't want to interact with other people. But one of the things that your story demonstrates is that that's actually not true, that many of these people were very interested in interacting with other people who shared their interests. Was that a surprise to you?
It was very much a surprise. Generally, with people who are so interested and so immersed in their imaginations, it seems to be like a very exclusive activity, like you're not a part of it. So when I went to the convention, I expected to be really detached from it and not get a lot of people reaching out and bringing me in. But that I was totally wrong about that. Everyone gave you an encyclopedic answer for everything. There are no short answers at Mysticon.
One of the other things I was curious about is how did people feel about being written about? Because you can see it from either perspective. You can see where people would be very interested to have people share their experience and understand their experience. And you could also see where people might be a little worried about people making fun of them or not understanding what they're all about.
Yeah, that's something that I figured out when I was down there. No one is like that. I guess people down there at the convention weren't really interested in what you thought about them. They were more interested in playing the game or discussing the game or discussing, you know, A Call of Cthulhu, which is a short story by H.P. Lovecraft, a 20th century horror writer. They were really interested in talking with other people who were like-minded. And if you didn't like those things, they didn't really care.
Well, okay. Finally, before we let you go, you mentioned in the piece that you had kind of an epiphany about these conventions and about the people who would attend them. Can you tell us about that moment?
Yes. There was a chair. There was this man who had a replica of the Captain Kirk's chair from Star Trek. And everyone was walking by it and sitting in it and taking pictures in it, and everyone was having a good time. But for me, who's someone who never watched Star Trek, it didn't seem like something I wanted to do. But you know, to come round out my experience at Mysticon, I went back to the chair and I sat in it, and it was actually not as bad as I thought it was.
Okay. Are you tempted now to dress up like Captain Kirk?
Not
you
Captain
can tell
Kirk.
Me, just between us. Just me and the hundreds of thousands of other people listening to your show.
If I had to go back, I'd probably dress up as a Ghostbuster.
Good choice. George Gonzalez is a freelance writer. His story, Lost in Space, was featured in this week's Washington Post magazine, and he was kind enough to join us in our Washington, D.C. studios in disguise as a regular guy. George Gonzalez, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Let's update you now on a new partnership in the news business. ABC News and the Spanish-language TV network Univision have announced they're joining forces. They're creating a multi-platform news service. The language will be English. The target is Latino audiences. NPR's Mandelito Barco explains.
The new joint venture hopes to capture a part of a fast-growing demographic, U.S.-born Latinos who prefer to get their news in English. Brad Sherman, who heads ABC News, says he's excited to team up with the Spanish-language media giant Univision. He says the programming will include news and information delivered by some new and some familiar faces.
You're going to see some of the great journalists from ABC News, Diane Sawyer, Barbara Walters, George Stephanopoulos, Robin Roberts, Elizabeth Vargas. You'll also see some of the great anchors and correspondents from Univision, including Jorge Ramos and Maria Elena Salinas.
ABC and Univision executives discussed this move for more than a year, hoping to begin in time to cover the presidential election. But the new 24-hour TV network won't be on until after the new year. The new digital platforms, online and on mobile devices, are set to begin this summer.
Univision y ABC News anunciaron hoy que han acordado...
Univision news anchors say the network is reaching beyond its usual Spanish-speaking audience, and the news was warmly received by the hosts of ABC's Good Morning America.
Such a bold step. Just huge. And there's no other way to say it.
An influential group.
Absolutely.
And I tell you what, it's something we had to do.
Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News.